Hi. So today on the Loopcast, I have Christian with me, the chief scientist at Veracode. I think if you're on Twitter, you know him by Dill Dog. So today we're going to talk about, I think our conversation today is going to be a little more historically driven and a little more about sort of looking at the broader themes and ideas in information security and application security. I think previous in our series, in our InfoSec series, we've covered more strategic ideas and focused on strategy and operations. And I'm sort of curious to look at more of the history and maybe try to develop a context around what we see as modern information security and modern application security. And so I think Christian was probably one of the better or best people to help me puzzle through this. I want to start off with maybe just going through what you see as a history of information security, and starting in the 90s and sort of working our way to today. What do you see as sort of the history and sort of the key points that we should be paying attention to and looking at?
Hi. First, thanks for having me on. In terms of a historical viewpoint on computer security and security vulnerability and sort of the growth of the industry, I got started with things in 1996. I had a passing interest in security before then, but I didn't know anybody from the industry at all. It was pretty fledgling at the time. People were pretty much obsessed with the bug track mailing list and publishing new vulnerability information there. I had gone to MIT for my college education, and they have a pretty hack-friendly environment there. I would say that everybody that's a freshman there learns to pick locks is like one of the first things that they do. And building hackers tend to crawl up on top of roofs everywhere and pull pranks like putting cars on top of buildings and things. So the culture there really encouraged me to explore security and explore the security of MIT's network and computers around there. I remember being handed a Class B of address space to play with for just my fraternity house. That was to me like fascinating. I could make whole Class C's appear and disappear. So that piqued my imagination, and I started looking at the things that I could play with. And back in the day, Solaris was where everyone was keeping all their awesome, private information. Unix was, commercial Unix was definitely the way to go for the big banks and the financial firms and the, anybody that had important data. So there were a lot of exploits and stuff being written. I remember when some of the sort of seminal work on buffer overflows came out, the Smashing the Stack paper from LF1 and things like that. And I read those, and I got kind of into the idea that maybe Windows was vulnerable to the same thing. All of these papers were about how to exploit Unix vulnerabilities, and Windows came along, and nobody cared. That was the thing. 1995 rolled around, Windows 95 came out, and basically nobody cared about the security of it. For the most part, people said, Windows doesn't have any, nobody uses Windows to store anything important. It's just grandma's pictures or whatever. So nobody cared really about it, but it didn't deter me. I really wanted to see about, writing vulnerabilities for it and writing exploits. And I kind of got into the whole thing because I wanted to write video games originally, and found that the writing exploits was a lot like writing the inner loop of a renderer in terms of understanding the assembly at the lowest levels. So I ended up writing some of the first buffer overflow exploits for Windows. I don't know if they were the first, but I haven't found anything earlier out there, and I didn't know of anything at the time. So if anyone out there knows of exploits for Windows, earlier than 1996, I'd love to know about those things. Anyway, I've just been, it's been a long haul since then. Obviously, you know, buffer overflows and format string attacks and all those things were pretty easy to find and easy to write back then. I'd say none of those exploits that I wrote took me more than a week to do. You know, today that's unheard of. You know, the amount of care that software developers take with their code is generally a lot. There's a lot more care taken with critical code, and you know, the really big juicy targets like operating systems and things like that are becoming much harder to exploit. Doesn't mean that doesn't happen. Obviously, it does. And you know, the big web servers and things like SSH. You know, occasionally, you know, you get the big heart bleed type thing these days. You know, but I'd say it's like once every 2 years something really earth shattering comes out. You know, it's not like every month. You know, I remember when I was at Loft, we had the notion of doing a 40 bug week one day. We put everybody's resources together and came up with 40 exploits. And we just laid out like eight a day for 5 days straight. You could do that, you know, by, you know, sort of mass scanning of open source code and things like that. So, you know, that kind of thing is totally unheard of these days. You know, nobody does 40 bugs in a week. You know, it's ridiculous. That said, you know, because these vulnerabilities have become more difficult to exploit and harder to write exploits for, they've become much more of a commodity than when I was doing a lot of my original research. You know, it's become extremely valuable to have, you know, as they call it, weaponized, you know, 0 days. I hate that term because, you know, I don't think of it that way, but, you know, there's a certain breed of people that are very interested in exploits that are totally functional. I'm willing to pay a good amount of money for it. So, you know, these days there's a market for vulnerabilities that didn't really exist, you know, when I was doing this stuff. I mean, it did. There were people that would, you know, trade these things around, but it was mostly for, you know, just pwning people and not necessarily for money or for, you know, it was just to see how many machines they could collect, really, how many accounts you could get access to. It was more of a hobby or an obsession for some, but it wasn't really an industry of its own. Mirroring the whole rise of the white hat security companies that grew up, you know, I started with Loft as its first employee writing Loftcrack, you know, as the source of income for Loft. You know, it's a password auditor for Windows, still out there. It's actually the number one commercial software tool, commercial security tool on download.com right now. So it's still alive and kicking despite all the years. Anyway, it was through the Loftcast that we managed to start AtStake. And AtStake was sort of the first company that, I don't know, kind of bragged about hiring hackers as a, you know, one of the reasons why we, you know, had credibility was because we hired people that knew what they were doing. You know, rather than people who just came up as consultants, these were people who, you know, genuinely loved security and, you know, practiced it as their trade. You know, but anyway, naturally people were skeptical of that. These days, there are lots of companies that are like, we hire hackers, we're looking for hackers, we're looking for ethical hackers, we're looking for this, that, the other thing. You know, but it's not unheard of to use this word in, you know, recruiting literature and whatnot. You know, so I think, you know, at the time, AtStake didn't do a great job. It didn't succeed as a company, but it succeeded socially, and it succeeded to break some ground for a lot of the industry as it showed up later. But mirroring the white hat industry growth, there was a lot of black hat industry growth alongside that. And, you know, I think what we're seeing today is, you know, hoarding of vulnerability information, a very different style of attacking things than, you know, it's more surgical. It's, you know, chaining vulnerabilities together to you know, bypass things like sandboxes. You know, those things didn't exist back when I was doing exploits. You know, it's you know, sandbox escapes and revert. You know, I had hints about how to do return-oriented programming, Rob, back in some of my early exploits, but we didn't call it that back then. You know, we just kind of did it, and it didn't have a name. The techniques that people use today, have to be pretty sophisticated. There's a very steep learning curve to being able to truly exploit things. So naturally, you know, if you really wanted to pop something, chances are you're going to pony up a little cash to get someone to help you or get some code. Or you just happen to be, you know, able to trade something of value for it, maybe another exploit. But I think today, you know, that we've gone from, you know, a focus on network oriented vulnerabilities back in the 90s to the 2000s, where you had some growth and maturity in defending building stronger applications, building stronger networks. These days, the vulnerabilities that people are going to run into are going to be the more complicated exposed application security vulnerabilities, you know, which is why I started Veracode, is because, frankly, at stake in its consulting force could not, you know, despite having a lot of the best people out there, and at the time, at stake had about 150 people. I'd say there were maybe 400 really truly qualified professionals in the world that could do a job credibly back then, and you know, we had 150 of them. So you know, it was, it was the kind of thing that made you realize that because the human being was suddenly a commodity, and that you could charge top dollar, you still couldn't get to all of the problems people were having. The amount of code was far too high for code review, and fuzzing and other techniques just didn't have enough surface area and coverage to be meaningful. So, you know, there had to be technological improvement in order to be able to reach the sheer volume of vulnerabilities that, you know, people write on a regular basis. I'd say we still write a lot of vulnerabilities, but I think we end up, you know, lately security has become something that people are doing more proactively. I remember at the beginning of Veracode, we had to twist arms to get people to even try it. These days, people are being very proactive and using things like Veracode or other scanning tools, either commercial or free, proactively. You know, we definitely had a shift to proactive security across the board. You know, there are very few industries that can, you know, feign ignorance of the security problem or say, yeah, we'll do that later. You know, back in the day, you know, it was Microsoft and others that were just like, yeah, we'll get around to fixing that. That's when, like, secure@microsoft.com was an email address answered by one guy who mothballed, emails for a month before getting back to you. You know, nowadays, you know, these patches, you know, every freaking day or, you know, patch Tuesday or whatever, that didn't exist, you know. So, I mean, we've got infrastructure now that's making it harder to exploit things, and I think that's driving some of this economy that we see today.
So I want to sort of maybe focus our conversation a little and ask you, what do you see as the key drivers of sort of security and insecurity in this field? I mean, you know, you mentioned the idea that, you know, it's becoming a lot harder to find exploits, but at the same time, it seems like these exploits can, you know, fetch potentially $500,000 to $1 million to, you know, as low as $10,000 to $20,000.
Sure. Yeah.
So, I mean,
yeah, definitely. The drivers that I'm seeing right now are the volume of compartmentalization in code and a lot of code reuse. Newer programs these days are written with a lot more reused code. Now, this could be good. This could be very good because you fix a bug in one place and it fixes it everywhere. That said, if the code is buggy absolutely everywhere, then it's also distributing bugs everywhere. So, rather than sort of the monolithic giants that you used to see, you're seeing a lot more code that is written in a federated way. Even in the commercial space, you know, there's a lot more code sharing, and, you know, it's like the the Boeing Dreamliner. You know, that thing was built in 100 different countries or something, right? It was all assembled at the last minute by, you know, one assembly line after all the parts came in the mail, you know? So same thing with all this code. You've got code from all over the place, you know. We used to call it soup, I guess, software of unknown pedigree. You just didn't know where it came from, really. You know, you could account for maybe where the library that your LinkedIn came from, but you're not sure where they got that code. You know, we've had enough time for some of the vulnerability supply chain to grow quite a bit. You know, it's longer and longer all the time. So, you know, I'm finding that, you know, through some of the statistics that we get from Veracode, we get a sense for how much code is being reused, and it's starting to grow quite a bit. You know, we can look at software composition across all of the different pieces of software that we look at, which is a lot, you know, and see what's common and, you know, who's borrowing code from who, really. There's a lot of vulnerabilities that I think are coming from modules that are linked in everywhere, but are not really tested independently. Maybe one program that uses it doesn't use it in a bad way, but another program does. You have to test the whole program, and you can't test just a library by itself. So, yeah, I'm finding that the drivers for insecurity really are obscurity. It's because programmers, when a program gets to be a certain size, you can't just look at something and say, boy, that's done wrong. You know, you just have to assume that the rest of the code was done correctly, you know. So, you know, as we compartmentalize for, you know, and abstract the code that we write, that we are also abstracting away vulnerability. So, again, this is why automation is becoming really important. You know, so the driver for vulnerability is obscurity and complexity, and the driver for, you know, remediation of these things is automation. You know, if you wanted a more real-world example, you know, the attackers really only need to find one vulnerability in your infrastructure or your application to get in. Maybe a chain off of that one, but you need one way in. You know, and as a defender, you need to fix everything. By that very nature, the problem is tipped toward that of the attacker. They also have an infinite amount of time to study your environment and plan their attack before they finally launch it. You know, incident response, you know, is exactly that. It's responding after you've already been attacked, which might be too late if the attack is well crafted. So, you know, automation really is the only way out of this. You know, you've not only got an infinite number of problems to fix, you've got to deal with an attacker that has an infinite amount of time. You know, so people need to be automating. And that, honestly, the problem has gotten so big that it's really hard to find a consulting team of just individual people that can go around and really genuinely say that your infrastructure and your applications is secure. And what do you got if you got 100 applications? You know, a consultant looks at 10 of them because that's all he can get to. The next time he looks at those 10, after you've maybe made some fixes, he might not have the same things to say about it. You know, it's not consistent either. You know, we need consistency if we're going to be fixing software, and we need automation so we can get to it all. So that's again why that's what's been driving me personally.
I'm sort of curious then, in terms of defense.
Yeah.
How far do you define defense? Because it seems like if you produce, in theory, the most secure app, and it, you know, it's an app that's secure all the time, but then what happens when you have dependencies that are outside that app? For instance, sure. Something like OpenSSL or I'm going to use a very general, something like Linux. For instance, yeah. I mean, how do you incorporate that into your defensive posture in terms of securing your app and securing your infrastructure?
Well, the best practices these days is to employ a layered approach. So, in terms of operating system defenses, you want a lot of real time stuff, a lot of you know, program monitoring and resource restriction. You know, if you're using Linux, you should be using, you know, there's an NSA guideline thing that they published on how to configure SE Linux and things like that. You know, that's a really great document for locking down OS. I mean, basically, you got to look at it in multiple layers. You know, it used to be you could just throw a firewall in front of things, and that was, you know, at least a start. But nowadays, you've got all the applications reach right through that firewall. You know, so people toyed with application firewalls for a while, but it turned out that without understanding the state of the application, that those firewalls oftentimes were not sufficient. You know, it's fine to still use them, but you know, it only would stop the most basic of attacks most of the time. You know, so defense in depth really for applications involves trying to get your analysis process done as early as possible in your development lifecycle. You know, you don't want to wait till you've already shipped the thing that you're writing. And the other thing that you can do is, because scanning services do exist today, if you're purchasing software and you don't trust it, you should be able to demand that they get it tested before you even install it. You know, if you're a big company and you've got a lot to lose, you should be able to throw a little weight around and tell the person that's selling you, a vendor that's trying to, you know, sell you a thing, you know, go get a scan. You know, let's find out what your vulnerability profile looks like. Let's see how much effort you've really put in. I know that Veracode offers scans like that, you know, on behalf of scanning vendors on behalf of enterprises. That way we can become part of the purchasing infrastructure. You know, that snaps the back of the vulnerability supply chain a little bit, because, you know, for every transaction there's some trust involved. You know, you buy something, you trust it. If you're installing something on Linux, you got to trust Linux, you know? So, you want to be able to demand that the things that you use have some sense of, that you have some idea of how secure those things are. You know, now you can't just, you know, wait till you've assembled the whole lot and then, you know, review it all at once. You need to be looking at it as layers and pieces. The problem just gets complicated so fast. You start off with a single machine and it's OS, and then there's apps on that, and then those apps are connected to other apps in the network, and then you've got a whole, you know, network segment and a bunch of routers and, you know, infrastructure and a corporate firewall and the whole internet. I mean, this, you're not going to scan the whole thing. But if you look at, say, the perimeter of your enterprise, scanning that at least for all of the low-hanging fruit, like hitting all the ports, making sure you understand what you're running. You know, I can't count the number of times that Veracode has scanned a large enterprise, you know, tens of thousands of external IPs, and they had no idea how half of those servers were even out there. They didn't even know. People, the most telling question that we always ask customers, and this is within the first 24 hours, we ask them, how many applications do you have in your infrastructure? Not even how they're written or how you write them. How many do you have? And it usually takes them a couple weeks to be able to figure it out. They don't have that information ready. And more to the point, that just belies exactly how haphazard security analysis really is a lot of the times. You know, we help people get their ship together so they know exactly what they have to protect, and, you know, get them a process by which to do that. You know, that's the kind of maturity that I expect that security consultants and security companies like Veracode will be able to provide these days, and, you know, and why we need to do that.
So, I mean, it also seems like the nature of what we have to secure has also changed, because, I mean, it's...
Sure.
We're talking about servers and routers and, you know, a traditional sort of corporate arrangement, but, I mean, you know, in the last 2 or 3 years, we've seen, you know, car hacking. I mean, to use
yep.
a very sort
sure.
of popular references, I mean, do you see, you know, how would you go about applying, you know, sort of the security ideas that you've outlined for us to something like a car, to something like a drone, to even a medical device?
Sure. One thing, you know, you're bringing up a lot of systems on the fringe of you know, embedded systems, and you know, you'll find that a lot of these things are running some kind of Linux under the cover, a lot of customized environments. Yeah, those are the harder platforms to deal with, but they typically don't run that much software because they're so obscure. There's only a couple apps that they need to that need to be analyzed. You know, so you know, a full design review of those things is not completely out of the question still. You know, it's when you've got a framework that you, you know, are using. Let's say you've got a, you know, a marketing department that loves to publish small websites, you know, they're going to be your huge risk. You know, they're going to be the ones that have made 5,000 Ruby on Rails apps with mass assigned vulnerabilities without realizing that they've done it. You know, and they're just going to hang them out there, and you have no idea that they're out there. They're out there. You know, so I mean, where the big data, where the personal vulnerability, you know, exists many times. You know, it's either, you know, your personal information that's on like a Windows machine somewhere, you know, or it's on a social network or whatever. You know, the number one way that people still get popped is through passwords. That's why I was writing Lovecrack, is to raise awareness of that. You know, the you know, people get popped because some, you know, they share a password from one account to another. One account gets hacked, and then, you know, the attacker follows them into all their other accounts because they use the same password everywhere. You know, that kind of thing has even happened to me. You know, I've made that mistake. Don't do it anymore, obviously. You know, you get popped once and you realize that was stupid. You know, shouldn't have done that. You know, for some people, you know, it results in fraud. For some banks, it results in millions and millions of dollars worth of fraud. You know, so, you know, invariably, you know, we still are fighting a war on the personal front. And, you know, the one thing that people, that you can do in a corporate environment that you can't really do just with individuals is you have to assume that even your employees are potentially hostile at a in an enterprise. You know, you could have somebody contract a virus on their laptop at home, bring it into the office, and plug it in the internal network and let it go a little, you know, go have a field day. You know, those controls that would prevent that from, you know, being a reality don't really exist for someone's personal information. You know, everyone needs to sort of take, you know, control of their own security. This means, you know, encrypting when you can, not being afraid to do that. You know, having a password, you know, the number one thing that would like cut half the amount of attacks in the world in half would be using software like 1Password. You know, sure, those things can be hacked too, but it's way better than typing in a memorable password everywhere. You know, use a password manager, for Christ's sake. You know, it's those things are free. Just go get it and use it. You know, so I mean, the remediation advice is going to be way different for, you know, a corporation who's basically looking at their employees as points of risk versus a person. You know, an individual person is going to look at the world around them as a point of risk. So, you know, the remediation techniques are going to be different, and the things you have to worry about are different.
So I want to maybe switch topics a little, and this is going to seem abrupt, but I want to talk about politics, because okay. I think
there's a lot of that.
Well, I mean, the image when you mention Loft is the image of, you know, 5 or 6 guys, long hair, like very stereotypical 90s hackers, giving testimony in front of Congress.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, watching.
Yeah, yeah. I remember this all happening, so.
But, I mean, our conversation up to now has been very sort of technological and very focused on the issue of software and securing software. But where do you factor in politics? Where do you factor in let's just start with Congress. Where do you factor in, you know, the law and sort of lawmakers?
Yeah. I'm not much of a politician. I was not actually in the room when the Loft testified. I joined the Loft 1 month after they did that. I regretted not joining sooner. You know, it's been a pretty cool trip to do, but I basically back then, in 1990, that would have been 96, 97, something like that. Maybe 98. Anyway, Congress and the NSA and others were just really getting started understanding what the scope of, this whole thing we've started to call cyber. Back when I was, in 1998, if somebody told me, to use the word cyber in front of me, it meant something completely different. And for the most part, he didn't talk about it. The notion of vulnerabilities being a weapon was very nascent. The idea that you could, do nation-scale harm with an exploit was news to people's ears. The idea that guys like The Loft, could make a claim that the internet, the whole thing, could be taken down in 20 minutes with the proper exploit was baffling. It was, they just wanted to hear us say it in public. So they called us down there and we said it. We didn't, on the floor explain exactly what vulnerability we were talking about, but, it's been a while and it's mostly fixed now. So, it was a BGP spoofing problem. You could, craft border gateway protocol packets in such a way that they provided false updates from to the various BGP servers on the ASNs. You were able to convince them that routes should be propagated that were not correct. As a result, you could send all of Russia's packets to South America and vice versa. And it would take a while for them to all figure out again, once you stop doing it, what the actual routing of the internet was. So yeah, it was possible to take it down. It was possible to make it so confusing that nobody could use it. Because if you could prove, if you could pretend to be a trusted machine and provide a bunch of updates to the rest of the world, then there you go. That was it. As we've gotten better at not changing things. I mean, every time you make a big change to things like internet routing, you have a chance to open up vulnerabilities and holes. We're getting better and better over time about not fixing things that aren't broken. We're adding new layers, but we're not necessarily destroying the security of the layers underneath those things, which is why when a big vulnerability like Heartbleed shows up these days, it's a huge deal because it's a vulnerability from the past, really. It's a vulnerability on a level that's much deeper than, we trusted SSL, right? We trusted this, we trusted that. When it's something we implicitly trust that has the vulnerability, then you're like, how long was that there? How long were people really vulnerable? And we just didn't know about it. On the political level, I think a lot has been done in the name of hacktivism lately. Hackers and wannabe hackers have invoked techniques like denial of service attacks and other high visibility, low skill level kinds of things to, perform acts of civil disobedience in a really public, obvious way. The advent of that really has thrust hacking into the limelight of politics as something that, can be influential. I'm still amazed occasionally by, some of the anonymous stuff, frankly. The notion that what was effectively a really good meme could become a really good political movement is pretty fascinating. The whole Occupy thing, I think we're seeing the gestation of a whole new political organ in the body of the world. You know, I'm not saying it's a whole new country or a whole new religion, you know, but there's a thing out there, and it basically anytime somebody wields enough power to raise the attention level of the rest of the world and make them look at you, then they're a force to be reckoned with. You know, it could be, you know, you've got presidents and popes and hackers these days, you know. So, you know, who's gonna influence the laws? You know, I mean, we have to lobby. We have to, applaud things like Demand Progress, you know, that, you know, has done a great job bringing technical issues into limelight. That was Aaron Swartz's project before he died there. I still donate to Demand Progress. It's pretty cool. You know, Lawrence Lessig is working on the on his new project, you know, to get people into Congress that get it, you know, people that have the awareness of, you know, what the tech world needs. We can't be hamstrung by laws that are ineffective, and, you know, things like the CFAA that are just ridiculous in scope, equating, you know, minor, in my opinion, online fraud with, you know, putting, you know, rapists in jail and things like that. I mean, it's ridiculous, you know. There are a lot of cases here where the law needs to catch up, but we need to be, you know, heavily involved in getting people into the political arena that know what they're doing, so that the right laws can be made.
So, I mean, how much of this is tech folks not being able to articulate a sort of political platform versus ignorance on sort of the part of the audience? Because, you know, I always have a sort of difficulty grasping this. Sometimes, you know, when I talk about technology, it almost seems like it falls on deaf ears. You know, I have to go back and explain basics and then work up to my point. But it almost seems like when I get into situations like that, it's almost a problem of, am I articulating that position and that idea correctly versus is my target audience understanding what I'm talking about?
Right. In any communication like that, you know, you've got, you know, communication is part of the problem of the person speaking and part of the problem for the person listening. You know, if they, the conversation needs to take a longer time, and, you know, it's taken plenty of time. You know, the first reaction when people see, you know, computer hackers is, you know, has always been fear. And then fear tends to drive policy pretty quickly to the extreme. You know, it's about realizing the sort of humanity of the whole thing, and that sometimes the people are just exploring, or it's not really dangerous what they're doing, or perhaps some fundamental concepts that need to be communicated, even down to like the elementary school level, just aren't there for most people. So, you know, it takes time for someone to understand some, you know, very basic things that anyone who's really into technology would totally get. You know, a good example there is software piracy. You know, when we talk about free software, you know, we say things like, you know, copying software. What does that mean? You know, people think they understand what that is, but then they think about downloading, and then they think about piracy, and it invokes the notion of stealing, like they're taking a thing, and, you know, they're taking it from someone else. If, you know, you were stealing a book, you would take a book, and then the person wouldn't have the book anymore. When you steal software, you're making a copy of the software, and the person that you copied it from still has the software. It's not like you're actually taking it. So it's not like a bowl of spaghetti. You take spaghetti out of the bowl, there's less spaghetti for everybody else. That's stealing, you know. But the notion that we've managed to confuse the public by saying that piracy is the same as stealing robs us of the right words to describe what's going on out there. You know, hacking, when I started doing it, people were really fighting to make sure that people use the word hacker correctly. You know, where their definition of hacker meant, you know, somebody who solved problems and exploited systems in a unorthodox fashion. You know, these days it's almost guaranteed to invoke, you know, the anonymous mask and people breaking into websites or something like that. People breaking into your accounts on Facebook or whatever. That stuff is a shift. You know, I think, you know, to a certain extent, on both sides, they have to, one, make an effort to understand the terminology of the other and, you know, accept, you know, the hacker community sort of has to accept that when they use certain words, they're going to be interpreted a certain way. You know, we tend to be pretty ego-driven and we like the word hacker, so we tend to defend it and use it in ways that others might not understand. You know, it depends on, you know, your willingness to bend toward your audience a bit when you're communicating. The one thing about the legal arena and the political arena is, you know, they've got their own lingo for everything. And a lot of it is borrowed from the people that they work with the closest, which is going to be military almost all the time. So the new cyber lingo, you know, has thrust words like the, you know, phrases like the kill chain and, you know, stuff like that into people's ears. That didn't come from the community. That didn't come from hackers. It didn't come from people out there. You can't, you know, just you Joe Schmo. It came from, you know, soldiers. It came from war. So we have more and more terminology coming all the time. And it's not clear that everybody understands everything, you know. So, you know, communication is a big, huge deal, but, you know, consensus is even a bigger one. You know, we can all agree on the meaning of words, you know, but then once you do that, how do you determine what good is? You know, how do you determine what an appropriate penalty is? You know, when a corporation says that a hack cost them billions of dollars, are they doing the world a huge disservice in the name of money by making it seem like an attack that maybe only cost them, you know, $20,000, you know, someone's time to fix and some unknown amount of brand reputation issues, but, you know, did it really take a couple billion dollars out of their pocket? Or are they exaggerating to the point that we have, you know, inflated the... you know, what an attack from a hacker looks like to this monstrous level. You know, I'm not saying that it's, you know, I'm not saying it's harmless, what a lot of people do, but there's a big difference between, you know, Civil Disobedience Act and, you know, stealing millions of dollars from a bank. It's totally... totally different, but we will take the little DDoS kid and throw him in jail for 15 years. I mean, you know, so at some point we have to realize the humanity in it all and understand that maybe, you know, we treat hacking and hacking related crime like we're treating marijuana. You know, we used to throw marijuana users in jail for a really long time. Some places still do, you know, but for the most part, there's a trend toward legalizing it. I'm not saying legalize hacking, but maybe we, you know, look at the people behind it and say, some of these people got some problems. You know, they're hacking habitually to the point of harming others without any regard for them. You know, it's more like antisocial behavior or sociopathic behavior than anything else. You know, people just, you know, maybe we need hacker rehab. Somebody needs to do that. Hackers Anonymous. We shouldn't call it that. There's already Hackers Anonymous. Anyway, but you know what I'm saying.
I do. I'm sort of curious. I want to go back to the point you made earlier and maybe – contextualize it for modern times. This idea that, you know, we've gone from 40 exploits a week to, you didn't say this, but going through 9 months for one exploit.
Oh, yeah, so, sure, that happens.
But I mean, is there a larger social movement from grokking, from understanding the system to now exploits as a commodity, exploits as a business?
Yeah, because the big driving thing is that when exploits were cheap to make, they were also cheap to give away. And educating people about what makes software vulnerable was easier to do in the 90s people weren't listening, but it was easier to teach them. These days, because the actual good exploits and how to write them they're so complicated and the skill set is so involved that you're going to be having a lot harder time finding people publishing meaningful exploits these days. It's going to be a lot harder for you to find it. It's going to be harder to gain that knowledge. You know, so yeah, I think we've, started to commercialize a little bit on both ends. You know, I know the black hats out there, busily working on things, and then the people who are sort of gray hat or white hat out there, are learning these techniques and trying to, sort of be ahead of the game. But it's a lot harder for everybody these days. You know, that's why you're not, if you wanted to learn, some of the exploit techniques that are in use today, it's just a lot harder to get to the point where you can even start to learn that stuff.
But in terms of political involvement, you do have somebody like Chris, pardon if I mispronounce his last name, Soggy Sohayon or whatever, the guy at the ACLU.
Yes.
Because it almost seems like this conversation about 0 days and the exploit market has sort of, in terms of politics, has created this label, merchants of – he uses this phrase, merchants of death, very sort of
– flippantly. Yeah.
Flippantly. But it almost seems like politically, there's some companies that sort of embrace that trolling.
Sure.
Volpin or even Exodus Intelligence. But, my question is, how do you sort of engage politics and engage the polity when – you have parts of the community that, for lack of a better word, want to troll and sort of, embrace this idea of being a merchant of death or, the idea of, embracing the black hat, but not being a black hat.
Sure. Well, that's a tough one. This is something that has been in the industry forever. There's always been people that identify with sort of black hat ethics to a certain extent that may or may not actually go out and commit crimes. The black hat ethic has evolved over time it used to be that, people that were sort of black hat did vulnerability hunting for fun. And that's why they did. They weren't trying to make the world a better place. They weren't trying to fix software. They weren't trying to make money. They were just doing it for fun. Nowadays, because of the commodity, because of the rarity and the prestige, I guess, associated with, being able to write some of these more complicated exploits, the black hat ethic has really evolved a lot. It's gone from, look what I can do. This is fun. Look at me. Into real careers in doing this. Even when those people choose an honest life, if you would, what drives them to create and explore systems is still going to be there. So there's a lot of companies full of people that are willing to go ahead and write, functional weaponized exploits. But the question is, do we care really? Anyone who's paid it sufficiently can probably drum up the resources to get somebody to help them get an exploit together. We used to joke really about nation states getting, teams of hackers together. These days it's for real. People are really doing that. It's not like it's just a club of people, looking to impress each other on IRC. There is that still. But that's really where it came from. You got to understand that the sort of big ego hacking really comes from a posturing thing that people do online. When you talk about trolling has come into its own as a as a way to hack people socially without actually hacking, like with software. It's a sort of we used to look at social engineering as the third branch of hacking back in the 90s. I would say that social engineering has evolved into things like trolling. You know, it's really about a way of getting people to react. It's psychology of, you know, frustrating people creatively. You know, that kind of thing has made people who otherwise wouldn't have the skill set to be able to participate in black hat ethics. That gives them a way of being able to express that. So you're seeing more and more of it because we've lowered the bar for the black hat. You know, they don't have to be experts in security to run a DDoS attack. You know, they can just use off-the-shelf tools. You know, script kiddies, we used to make fun of them. Nowadays, there's so many of them that you have to deal with them. You know, back in the 90s, you know, script kiddies, you just, you know, kick ban them off the IRC channel and then they go away. You know, and nowadays, basically, you know, it's like the bro movement, you know what I mean? You've got all these bros, you know, where the hell do these people come from, you know, but they found each other. So now there's a movement around it, you know, so, you know, the question is, just because you don't like something that someone does, you know, you don't like bros because they're too cheesy or they're too, too douchebaggy or whatever you want to, however you want to sling a word at them. You know, you look at script kiddies, you want to diminutize what they're capable of by saying, oh, they're not really writing their own exploits. They're only just using canned code or whatever. You can't really do that. You know, that's just a way of making yourself feel better. Fact is, they have a right to try to do whatever they can do out there. You know, the question is, you know, what are you going to do about it? That's the troll. You know, what are you going to do about it when, you know, shit goes down? You know, when someone does something bad to you, what are you going to do? You know, so, you know, these days it's all about, you know, I know that back in the 90s, Grandma didn't know anything about fraud. They didn't know anything about, you know, Facebook, and they didn't understand identity theft. Nowadays, I go talk to my grandparents, they know what identity theft is. You know, they understand what fraud and hacking is. Even the people that, you know, are the most vulnerable, most unlikely to be able to defend themselves, at least understand the scope of the problem. Now, this is huge. This is a huge level of awareness that didn't exist, you know, 10 years ago. Am I worried about, you know, whether or not people are going to, you know, whether or not we're doing enough fast enough? I think we are, you know, but I think sometimes it takes wake-up calls to remind people, you know, to call them to action, you know. Politically, you know, I'm of the opinion that we need to be continuing to educate on the real scope of what people, you know, what damage is done. You know, we need to make a differentiation between hacking and civil disobedience. You know, and stop making black and white out of absolutely everything. You know, hats or people's intentions. You know, I'm going to reserve my judgment on whether or not governments should be even meddling with this stuff, but you have to expect that there's an interest, and where there's a will, there's a way, you know. So, anyway, it's a lot there.
Right. I think we've covered a lot tonight.
Sure.
Usually, at the end of the show, we always like to give the guests the last word or something to chew on before we sign off. So give us a last word or something to think about before we leave for tonight.
If you want to get involved, I would, start educating yourself on the efforts of demand progress. I would look into Lawrence Lessig's Super PAC. If you have even a small amount of money to throw at these causes, I think that they're worth it. I think you're going to see some really good political action stuff coming from Lessig's thing. I would look at it pretty seriously. That's basically all I got right now.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.